Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today for our program. Normally, I would start the program with the latest on health and healing, all from studies published in the PubMed, National Library of Medicine, but today a little different. And why? Because yesterday I did a webinar, 5-hour webinar, on an important new documentary. And one of the people in a Q&A afterwards asked, Gary, when we have so many major corporations and television personalities and advertising telling us to do what they're suggesting because they're authority figures, you know, who are we to say no? And what is the problem when we end up taking their advice and their advice ends up being wrong? It was a good question. It was a very important question. And here's why it's important that we think about this. I'm in the middle of a very important clinical study on aging. It's being monitored by some of the most respected anti-aging scientists and physicians in the world. In fact, they're helping with it. They're paying for the blood workup, that we have different types of blood like methylating DNA to tell how old we actually are at the cellular level, and whether or not you're at the same age per cell, like is your heart the same age as your lungs? What depends? Everything's about our choices. If you were drinking, your liver, your kidneys, your heart, your brain are going to be older biologically because of how many brain cells you destroy. Not even getting drunk, just social drinking. If you exercise, it slows down the aging process. So everything depends upon intake. So we have one group of people came on campus, another group of people that stayed home. Now, since both of them are getting the same identical protocol, and in-depth conversations and counseling, and they're all eating the same foods, the same menus, the same supplements. They all have to take same supplements, which were paid for by one of the foundations. Then you would assume, right, that we should all have the same outcome. You all got the same input, then shouldn't we have something of a major output? And that's not what happened. In fact, over the last almost 4 years, we have disproven the idea that giving people what they need is what they'll use. So then I have to ask, well, what is the benefit of giving all this information every single day to the same people? They should be magnificently healthy. My personal experience is they're not. All the time I find people, oh, I listen every day, Gary, I listen every day. Why aren't you healthier? I think. And so where is the disconnect between knowing that it is better to prevent a disease because it's easier to prevent it than to deal with the consequences of having it manifest? Certainly a lot cheaper and a lot less stressful. Well, I'm dealing with people who hopefully will prevent the illness, but I'm also dealing with people who are sick trying to get them well. And it's always been that great divide. Why aren't people doing the right thing? When I was with Gloria Swanson, the great old actress who helped found Hollywood, and she had the political connections to get a school in Harlem to agree to do a healthy vegan cafeteria lunch that still had their regular lunch, but this would be an add-on. We'd start small and see if they liked it or rejected it. I created the menus and I did the dishes. And when she first saw it, she said, what's this? This isn't a healthy menu. I said, yes, it is. It is. I said, because this is a pizza. Well, that's not healthy. If it's a regular pizza, not healthy. But there's no dairy in this. There's no meat in this. There's no gluten in this. There's no refined carbohydrate. Everything in that pizza makes it look, smell, and taste like a regular pizza, but it isn't. And those hot dogs are not hot dogs. They're not made from meat or the chemicals or the dyes or the monosodium glutamate. And so I went through every item. And I showed that they were actually healthy foods disguised as junk food. So let's just try it. We did, and it was very successful. Then slowly, as they adapted to accepting that, we added in other dishes. Like I remember the first time we tried a miso soup with tofu and mushrooms. And they liked it. Not everybody was crazy about it, but it was very good for them. And in time, 90% of the students selected the healthy menu. And that was the first school in New York City to actively encourage students to eat healthy by actually giving them healthy foods. And it worked. Other schools contacted me afterwards, charter school, Montessori, etc. And I gave them the same protocols. So here is the takeaway message. It's how you approach change. Even on campus, we found that half the people on campus who were there every day being monitored, I was there, had a whole staff, half of them didn't do the protocol the way they were supposed to. For example, they didn't take their supplements at all in several cases, and others didn't do their mileage on the road. Others didn't do meditation, didn't do green time. They're out in a beautiful environment, trees that are gigantic and old, and all the richness of the pure environment, no pollution, and yet they were never out there enjoying it. Why? And I didn't know this till after the study, till I got the results. And I mean, it was just so clear. One group just excelled. Everything was benefit. Then they gave their diaries. I came with depression. I've had depression for 22 years. I no longer have depression. I feel great. I've had anxiety my whole life. I no longer have anxiety. You talk about the big empty, where you're working as hard as you can. You're busy, you're responsible, but you feel empty inside. I now feel no emptiness. My blood pressure was this. My blood sugar, now it's normal. And yet these other group, nothing. Nothing improved from the baseline when they started. Well, fortunately, the group that did follow the protocol did so well, we still had a 12% statistical improvement, which is substantial. And that's why we went forward to another one. But then there was a question. If you're right there on campus, if you have all these lectures and counseling, why are you not doing something that's in your best interest? You benefit from it. And I got all these answers. I talk with each one of these people personally. Well, you know, Gary, be realistic. You know, when you hit 70, you don't know if you're going to live very much longer. You know, the average lifespan now is about 75 years old. And so I'm just thinking, what's the point? Okay, that's fatalism, not uncommon. Apathy, not uncommon. Comfort was the number one reason people said that they didn't follow protocols. Well, you know, yes, doing this exercise, but I don't like exercising. And so they all didn't want to get out of their comfort zone. Okay, I learned something that was important for me. But then at home, the group at home, not a single person except one, but 53 other people didn't follow the protocols at all. And yet they had the protocols. So here's a question for you. If you have all the input, positive information that can help you prevent disease, live a longer life, reverse all the symptoms of premature aging, help you with your mind so you don't develop dementia, and help you prevent arthritis and osteoporosis and high blood pressure, diabetes, why wouldn't you do it? That gets to another issue, and that is our conditioned response. And this happens early in life, where the people in our life tell us what we should believe, and we believe them, and we try to do our best. We become the good daughter, the good son. We want to show them that we're honoring their input, and we have school teachers that reinforce that. And then one day we wake up, and maybe we've done the right thing. Maybe we've had really outstanding parenting. But what happens to all those times when there was doubt, insecurity, fear? We lock that into our DNA. Unless we process that, it'll stay with us. And it becomes a thing that says, nope, I got a good opportunity to get healthy and happy. I'm going to resist it. And then we start building the myth of the non-sacred being. Well, everything's relative, Gary. Well, what's the problem of having pollution, poisons, pesticides, hormones in moderation? Isn't it true? Everything in moderation? No, the fact that something is a moderate amount of a toxin just means it's going to take longer before it manifests, but sooner or later it will manifest. Every small problem that is avoided becomes a major problem. And that's how disease sometimes takes 20 years in one person and 40 years in another person. But eventually, it's going to be there. But then who's in that person's life to ask them to challenge bad habits, to get out of their comfort zone? to start raising their bar, to utilize what is in front of them. These are gifts. And yet today, look around, we have more morbid obesity than any country per population in the world. We have more obese children. We have more sick children. We have children born today that will not outlive their parents. That's a disgrace. But then again, we have more homeless children than any other developed country in the world. Almost 3 million homeless children. We have 16 million hungry children who are food insecure. How's that possible? It is when you don't consider it important. When you don't look for the problem, you're not going to find a solution. So we've narrowed our focus to just our day-to-day lives. And even within our day-to-day lives, just how do we get through this day? And we should have a broader worldview, universal truths. And I was happy to see that understanding all this and the human limitation and why people resist things in their own best interest, that yesterday, last evening after the webinar, I did another lecture for one of the groups who are in the anti-aging. We have two groups, one on campus and one at home. And this time, based upon what I've seen are the reasons people give for not doing good things for themselves, not making healthy choices. My whole lectures are based upon finding the confidence and courage to make right choices all the time. And thus far, according to Luann, all these individuals, every single one, is following the protocol. I'm getting very positive feedback from the individuals. So we're not getting excuses, we're getting results. After all, in life, you either give a result, hey, did that, or you make an excuse. Well, how could I? And just like the person yesterday, what did I say when I said, if you keep blaming everyone else for your failings and your fears and your insecurities, then you better start looking in the mirror. Take responsibility. After all, we can always say no to buying their exploited manufactured clothes, can't we? We can say no if we have a cell phone with a cobalt came from enslaving people in Africa, young kids. They're technically not enslaved, but they work as slave conditions and they die. And by the tens of thousands are working to get the cobalt. Do you have any responsibility for their struggles? Yes, you do. And what about all the food that we eat? You ever consider the farmer and the person you'll never know, never see his face, never know that name, who made the food for you, grew the food, went through all the hardships of drought and rain and high prices? So in a universal view is you see the interconnectivity of all things. So if I'm going to wear a suit, I'm going to make sure that it's not made by exploitative labor. I'm going to eat food that's going to be locally grown, organic and not genetically engineered. I choose not to read the New York Times. I choose not to read the Washington Post. I choose not to watch any of the commercial television programs at all because I know that they're not in balance. They're going to be biased, intentional or not. I know that I cannot just trust anything a doctor says before I challenge them. So I do my homework and see whether or not something they would suggest for me is doable or not, safe or not. I'm not going to trust any politician until I see, show me what you've actually done. And then I'll know whether or not that's possibly going to happen in a good way, or they're just going to go back to trusting their lobbyist. So you see, you can say no and get off their grid. You can not bank in their banks. You cannot buy their newspaper, watch their television, eat their food, shop in their box stores. You have that choice. That's your freedom of choice. Get out of your comfort zone and then make much better choices, as some of you already are. And for those of you who've been doing exactly this, good for you, because you may be the only person around you doing it. But don't feel bad if you're making good choices. And those people, they're just not ready for that message. They're not ready for that change. Okay, let's be patient. No shaming, but encouragement. Just put it out. If you need my help, I'm going to be there. Just let me know. Don't force, don't push, don't proselytize, don't preach. Okay? And hopefully, before disaster, they'll come around. Unfortunately, most people only come around when they're in a disaster. Then they're ready to hear a different message. So you see, this is important because just me giving information every day with the assumption that all the stuff I'm giving, or most of it, since it's good quality information, all meant to extend your life and prevent disease or reverse disease, if you're not using it, what's the point? Then you shouldn't be listening to my radio program. You shouldn't be coming to my webinars. You shouldn't be reading my books unless you intend to do something about it and challenge it. I put all my documentation right there in every article. And I just wrote the longest article along with the research done by an outstanding research editor. I don't want to get the people that are working with me hassled, and they will get hassled because the information I'm doing on all these topics, if they got people to change their mind, well, then that could cause economic challenge to those manufacturers. So let's just start making more reasoned choices. We're going to take a break and come back with a very interesting, insightful series of clips. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. How do we get to where we have so many crises all at once? How do we get to where we have this seeming contradiction? Young people screaming, cursing, fighting, harming, wanting to see people hurt or killed. And yet they say, you said a word, a professor says something in a class, and suddenly it triggers them. They no longer feel safe. They want to be treated with so much respect and gentleness. Well, you're not showing gentleness, you're not showing respect, and you're certainly not showing patience or how to deal with issues by condemning, going full force at someone. And that's what we're seeing constantly. We're seeing major cities, beautiful cities like San Francisco, St. Louis, and Chicago, Atlanta, Baltimore, destroyed. We're seeing lawlessness rewarded. We're seeing people for ideological reasons no longer find that the public should be kept safe, but rather the perpetrators, the criminals, should be protected. We see banks that caused all the problem in 2008 rewarded, and they're empowered today in causing the same problems as if no lessons had been learned. We saw no weapons of mass destruction, but nobody was fired. Nobody said, I'm sorry. And now we have the same phenomena happening in Yemen. With no irony that, gee whiz, I thought we were supposed to learn a lesson that was so devastating in its consequences. We see people coming out of college functionally illiterate in many colleges, not all, but especially in the humanities. How did we get here? How did we get so divisive? How did we get to where all of our efforts at human rights, women's rights, how did we get to where all that has been vanishing? And we're rewriting history to serve the needs of the most radical elements that are neither true nor objective. How do we get to this place? I'm going to show you each day this week. These are heavy hitters. These are deep thinkers. The first person is going to be in three different lectures that she gave. Short, 4 minutes, 4 minutes, and a little longer. But what she is saying, Melanie Phillips, and who is she? Well, for decades, she was one of the most liberal journalists in Great Britain. She worked for The Guardian until she began to see the contradictions piling up. She started to see that journalists were not looking for the truth, but rather aligning their stories with ideologies. And it angered her. So she left the left. The moment she did, by criticizing what was going wrong, they attacked her. So she's universally hated. So listen to what she has to say. You judge for yourself. I believe the You really need to hear an objective voice. You won't see her debated. She'll wipe the floor with anyone. All right? And I'm seeing more and more of these people who were historically liberal Democrats who are saying enough, just enough. I won't play in this game anymore. There's three separate clips on understanding how do we get here? How do we get to hating one another, the balkanization, the separation, the beauty of multiculturalism destroyed, the family destroyed, the fact that we would want to ban words like, don't you ever say mother to me, or woman, or husband, or brother, sister, aunt, uncle, grandparents. You can't say that. It offends me to such a degree that I have to run in and hug a teddy bear, call my helicopter mother and say, someone just said a bad word. How do we get here? She's going to give you her point of view. You can agree or disagree, but afterwards, call us at 888-874-4888 and give us your opinion. Now to the clips.
This is Stephen Edgington for The Sun, and today I'm interviewing Melanie Phillips. Melanie Phillips is an author, a commentator, and a writer. She used to work for The Guardian newspaper, although you probably wouldn't suspect that from some of the views that she holds. We're going to be talking about anti-Semitism, her journey from left to right, and the left in general. I have to apologise, unfortunately, there might be a noise in the background due to the wind bashing on a window behind us. We can't do anything about it. I'm extremely sorry. Despite our name, we don't control the weather, so enjoy the interview. Thank you very much for joining us. Can you explain what you think has happened to society since 1945?
Small question. I think that in the West, there's been a kind of cultural revolution that's gone on since 1945, since the end of the Second World War. And I think it very much actually has its roots in the war and the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust. In the 30s and 40s, because I think what that did to Europe in particular, but to the West in general, was to deliver a kind of seismic shock to what the West thought of itself. Because you had this unprecedented barbarism arising in the very heartland of high culture, enlightenment reason. And it didn't take place in some benighted cultural backwater in some far-flung part of the world. It took place in the heart of Europe. And I think what that did was to give people a terrible impression, a terrible message that this is what reason did, this is what the West did, this is what being a nation did. And so all those things became toxic and tainted. And I think that was a terrible mistake, personally, because what gave rise to Nazism and to anti-Semitism and to the Nazi Holocaust and to the war that followed was particular to a particular country at a particular time in history, governed by a particular set of circumstances and prey to a particular set of prejudices. But nevertheless, I think there was a kind of cultural demoralization that set in the West. And as a result, it became very vulnerable to people who wanted to change Western society completely. And they came out of the Holocaust, they came out of Nazi-dominated Europe, and they were revolutionary Marxists, many of them. And they basically said, we did this, capitalism did this, the West did this, Enlightenment reason did this, and we now have to have a new society. And so that set in train a whole series of, a whole set of thinking, which, because I think the West was demoralized, it was very receptive to these ideas, which basically involved overturning the basic tenets of Western civilization and the very idea of the Western nation state that embodied those concepts. So you had this great onslaught which took place progressively over the decades on the bedrock values of the West, transmitted through, for example, the traditional family, which became seen as the sort of epicenter of oppression, the onslaught on capitalism as a profoundly destabilizing and unfair doctrine, and the onslaught on education, Education is the transmission of a culture down through the generations. And I remember sitting through debates in the 80s and 90s in Britain, in which the received wisdom in the higher reaches of the education system was that you could not transmit the culture anymore down through the generations, because the culture was fundamentally rotten. It was fundamentally racist, it was white, it was colonialist, it was defined by colonialism, exploitation, capitalism. It had done down the poor at home and the benighted masses abroad, and consequently it needed to be completely revised and overthrown, and consequently you couldn't teach that to children. You had to teach them instead that they were born into a culture that was itself born in sin. And I remember those debates, and there was the people who objected to this as being ahistorical, false, malevolent, destructive, were just howled down as being, they would say that, wouldn't they? They are white, they are capitalist, they are the powerful. And so you had this destruction of the bedrock values of the West, and even more profoundly, you had a destruction, again, in the higher reaches of the universities, at the intelligentsia. You had the destruction of the very idea of truth itself, and this is how this worked. Again, arising from the experience of Nazi authoritarianism, Nazi totalitarianism, there arose a way of thinking which said, any kind of external authority is authoritarian. It's an intrusion on our personal freedom and has to be resisted. The only thing that now matters, the only thing that counts, is how we ourselves create our own lives. So what matters more than anything else is how we believe ourselves to be. What I think matters more than what you think. You cannot tell me I am wrong, because my view is the same as your view. There's no hierarchy of views. There can be no hierarchy of opinion, of values, of culture. Nothing can be better or worse than anything else. No one's lifestyle can be better or worse than anyone else. No one's family background can be better or worse than anyone else. No one's national culture or religion can be better or worse than anyone else. If you say that it is better or worse than anyone else's, then you're racist. So as a result, liberal society could no longer say that it was better than illiberal society. We could no longer say it was better, objectively better, to have a society based on ideas of equality between men and women, freedom of religion, and all the rest of it, because that was racist, because it distinguished us from those countries which didn't have that. So what mattered was how I felt was what was true. What I feel myself to think, what I feel, and my feelings, my emotions, are more important than any facts, because I create my own reality. And as a result of that, you had an erosion of the idea of objective truth. Objectivity went out the window. You couldn't have objectivity. You couldn't have rules of evidence. You couldn't have any rules. What I say is true is as true as what you say is true. It's all relative. And consequently, the world, as recreated along these lines, no longer understood the difference between truth and lies. And consequently, it accepted lies as truth. It was even worse than this, because in this great drive to get rid of any kind of external authority, biblical morality, of course, went out the window. Biblical morality was regarded as a grotesque intrusion onto personal freedom. And also it was based on the Bible, and who cared about the Bible? It was all magical, superstitious, mumbo jumbo, only believed by idiots and imbeciles. That's what we've been told for the last half century. And so biblical morality went out, and in came man-made morality, which was basically ideology, the power of the idea. And these ideologies were all basically designed to produce a kind of perfect world. They would get rid of prejudice from the human heart. They would prevent war from ever happening again. They would prevent Nazism from ever again stalking the corridors of free societies. They would produce a brotherhood of man. And consequently, they couldn't brook any opposition because they were all designed to better humanity in their own lights. And consequently, anyone who said there was anything wrong with any of them was somebody who wasn't just wrong-headed, they were somebody by definition who did not want to better humanity. So they weren't just wrong, they were evil. And so if somebody came along and said, you know, I don't think it's necessarily right that the West invented slavery. In fact, the West, everyone had slavery at one time. And in fact, Britain and America were the pioneers of getting rid of slavery. This is historical fact. But it goes against the ideology which says, you know, white people are intrinsically bad. And consequently, those facts could not be admitted as facts. And anyone who said them was by definition evil, because they were people who were against the whole anti-racist idea that only white people could be racist and all that. And consequently, you had a situation arising which we're living through, having sown the wind, we're reaping the whirlwind through identity politics, victim culture, woke stuff and all that, in which the power of the idea was absolute. It could not be gainsaid. And consequently, anyone who opposed it had to be treated as somebody who had to be shut down as being evil. And it's an amazing thing that in getting rid of biblical religion, what we've done by substituting man-made ideologies is produce something that's very, very similar to the very worst excesses of medieval religions. You have a dogma, you have a catechism. The dogma cannot be challenged. It must be enforced. Anybody who opposes it is a heretic who must be burned at the stake. Now, we don't burn people physically at the stake anymore, but we burn them in other ways. We deprive them of their livelihoods. We prevent them from being promoted. We prevent them from having their friends. We treat them as social pariahs and outcasts, and that's what we've done. So it's very, very similar to the medieval inquisitions produced by the Catholic Church, and then on through the French Revolution and subsequent secular revolutions, communist totalitarianism, and then fascism. We're reproducing those totalitarian cultures in a secular form, and on the basis that this is supposed to produce a better world, a freer world, a kinder, gentler world, in response to all those terrible things that happened in the past. We've gone full circle. This is all part and parcel of the substitution of knowledge by ideology. Ideologies of various kinds. Ideologies meaning the idea holds sway, absolute sway. Nothing can challenge the idea. Why? Because the ideas I'm talking about, the ideas that are now the absolute orthodoxy on the left, are ideas which are said to embody goodness, virtue. They're said to embody the betterment of humanity. So if you stand against any of these ideas, if you say there's something fundamentally wrong with any of these ideas, you're not only wrong-headed, but you are evil, because you are standing in the way of the betterment of humanity. Therefore, you want bad things for human beings. You want bad things for the earth, for the planet. And consequently, you can't be argued against. You must be stopped. You must be stifled. You must be refused a platform. Nobody must hear what you say. So what are these ideologies? There are many ideologies. Multiculturalism, the idea that you cannot say Western society or any society is better or worse than any other. Lifestyle choice, the idea that you cannot say any kind of family household arrangement is better or worse than any other, and so on and so forth. Now, the point about an ideology, as I've just said, is that the idea is absolute. It cannot admit to any dissent or challenge whatsoever.
So they actually do believe in a truth, in an absolute truth.
Well, rather like the Catholic Church of medieval period believed in the absolute truth. But the fact is this, an ideology is therefore inimical to reason itself. Because if you come along with a set of facts and you say, here are facts which challenge your idea of whatever it is, here are facts which show that children are better off with a father and a mother. Here are facts which show that the earth was warmer many millennia ago. Here are facts which show whatever. And they contradict the governing idea of the ideology. You are told, no, we cannot have this. These cannot be facts. You are lying. You must be lying. And we won't even hear these facts. In other words, we're in a situation now where ideology says evidence is nowhere. Now, if evidence is nowhere, then rationality and reason are nowhere, because you cannot have reason without evidence and without the idea of truth and lies being different from each other. And so we have this really horrific and terrifying situation in which the brightest and the best of us in our universities, the people entrusted with the education of our young people, the people entrusted with the transmission of our culture, the people entrusted with thinking great thoughts, are themselves promulgating a culture which has become inimical to reason itself, and they believe that they stand for reason. They believe, and they tell us, that anyone who objects to any of this is stupid, is an imbecile. Their imbecility demonstrated by the fact that they believe in something as ridiculous as objective truth. But they themselves are presiding over and have made our universities into crucibles not of knowledge, but of the destruction of reason itself. And so what we're living through in Britain and the West, in my view, is even worse than the potential destruction of political liberty, even worse than the destruction of the very idea of the Western nation and national identity. We're living through the destruction of reason. And all around us, we find that rational argument, discussion, civil discourse, encompassing ideas which may compete with each other. We may have disagreements and be civil to each other. All gone, replaced by insult. Insult designed not just to wound, but to silence.
To silence.
To shut down the argument.
Silence, yeah.
Back in the 1990s, I managed to secure for myself entry to an inner circle of hell by arguing that in general, children were best served by being brought up by their own mother and father. Of course, I said, some marriages would always fail, and of course, many lone parents did a heroic job in bringing up their children. But surely it was best to avoid such disadvantage wherever possible. This was denounced as heartless, cruel, anti-feminist, and of course, right-wing. Somewhat to my surprise, therefore, I was approached by a TV producer to make a film about my views on the destruction of the nuclear family. Since I was already cancelled in all the best circles, I asked the producer why he wanted to publicise my views. "You're so reactionary, you're now in the very vanguard of progress," he replied. Given what I then went on to say in subsequent years about the destruction of education, multiculturalism, the demonization of men, Islamization, and anthropogenic global warming theory, I obviously became so progressive, I managed to advance to the very end of time itself and meet myself coming back. Now, the onslaught on the traditional family was an early example of a world turned upside down, in which certain kinds of disadvantage became a human right, victim status weaponized, bullying and bigotry against those who were denied this status, and untold numbers of children were sacrificed on the altars of mass fatherlessness, the willful promotion of ignorance in the classroom, and the infantilization of adults. This all-out onslaught on the nation and its core social and moral norms has created what is now an age of unreason. Language has been hijacked and evacuated of meaning. Anti-racism means people are now judged and damned, not for the content of their character, but on the white color of their skin. People with male genitalia are said to be women and are indeed hailed as female role models. Dissent from any of this means vilification, character assassination, and intimidation. It's reminiscent of the Salem witch hunts and the Soviet show trials. Liberal tolerance has been replaced by cultural totalitarianism, and not just by the usual suspects on the left, but now by many of the professions, many businesses, and I'm afraid to say, across Whitehall. In short, we are living through a 5-decades-old revolution. Now, as we know, conservatism was supposedly created when Edmund Burke defended the cultural architecture of a free society that depended on traditional institutions. Burke wasn't actually a conservative. He was, in many respects, a radical, opposing the unrestrained power of the monarchy and supporting the revolting colonials in America. But he did understand the acute threat the French revolutionaries posed to civilized life under the guise of progress. Today, we have the equivalent of the guillotine in cancel culture. Our own Committee of Public Safety, orchestrating a dictatorial reign of terror, is composed of the Labour Party under Sir Keir Starmer and the university vice-chancellors. And just as Danton and Robespierre were themselves finally consumed by the conflagration they'd unleashed, today's revolution is also eating its own, as one-time radical feminists are purged by those who believe that biological fact is fiction.
I've been in the educational system at the college level, university level, fairly Dickens University, and adjunct professor there for a long time. I never had a problem in a class in 45 years. To the contrary, the dean of the university would drive me in from Manhattan, from my apartment, and we'd talk going over, and couldn't use a classroom. Too many students. We had to use the auditorium, and it was full. And he'd stay, and then we would, you know, he'd drive me back. Wonderful human being, Dean Calusi. And in that process, I always started the class by suggesting, if there's anything I'm going to share with you you're uncertain about, please, you know, let me know. If you have a disagreement, let me know. We'll talk through it. We'll see what we can learn. And so we had wonderful, invigorating classes where people look forward to coming back because it was challenging people to think deeper. And that was the whole purpose of the exercise. So in any case, what we didn't have is we didn't have layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of administrators, not teachers, administrators, bureaucrats who knew nothing. In fact, many bureaucrats were making more money than tenured professors or teachers, instructors. And now you go to any university and they'll have layer upon layer. They'll have dozens of these administrators, all making it more difficult for good quality teachers just to teach the subjects at hand. How do we get here? Here's someone who knows. She's still in academia. She's one of the most outspoken feminists in American history. Her name is Peglia. Now to her comments. They're short, but to the point. She really summarizes it very brilliantly.
Let's get started here. Part of what we're talking about this weekend at Reason is kind of the state of the university. And, you know, what is the university over as a meaningful place, as a site of new cultural production and knowledge? And we're going to be talking, you know, about students and the way students are controlled. But can you talk a little bit, how do you feel about the state of the university from the professor's point of view? Are professors, particularly in the arts and the humanities and the social sciences, are they bringing what they should be bringing to research universities?
or the universities are an absolute wreck, you know, right now, because for decades, any graduate student in the humanities who had independent thinking, was driven out. Okay, there was no way to survive without memorizing all of these stupid bromides with this reverential bowing to these overinflated figures like Lacan, Derrida, Foucault, and so on. And basically, it's been a tyranny in the humanities because the professors who are now of my age, who are the baby boom professors, who made their careers on the back of Foucault and so on, are determined that survive. And so you have a kind of vampirism going on. But I've been getting letters. For 25 years since Sexual Personae was released in 1990, from refugees from the graduate schools. Okay, so it's been a terrible loss. One of my favorite letters was early on. A woman wrote to me who she was painting houses in St. Louis, and she said that she had wanted a career as a literature professor and had gone into the graduate program in comparative literature at Berkeley. And finally, she was forced to drop out because she said every time she would express enthusiasm for a work they were studying in the seminar, everyone would look at her as if she had in some way created a terrible error of taste. I thought, oh my God, okay. That's what's been going on, is that a certain sort of a pretentious style of superiority to the text, and every text, of course, is supposed to be dissolving itself. Okay? So it's all self-reflexive. At the end, nothing means anything, and the professors believe that they have some, that this is an accomplishment to reduce great works of art to nothing. Let me just say. So graduate training has been systematically removing from the grad students the one thing you need as a teacher in the undergraduate classroom: enthusiasm, passion, conviction. Okay? An independent point of view.
So one of the things she mentioned, letters, I highly recommend, if you don't, read her, I guess it's weekly column at Salon, where Camille has been an advice columnist for 20 years or so.
It began as Spy magazine.
Along with, I think, Andrew W.K., who is a musician and motivational speaker in the Village Voice. These are the two great advice columnists, like Forget Ann Landers, Forget Dear Abby, and the range of topics that you cover, and it's really a fantastic thing.
When Spy magazine announced my debut and Agony Aunt column, Ask Camille, it was on the same cover that they had the great Hillary Clinton dominatrix cover. Okay, so it's been fantastic. There's Hillary Clinton in the White House, the Oval Office desk in a dominatrix outfit, and then there's a band. And Camille Paglia debut, Agony Aunt. Ask.
So what needs to change?
We've been joined to the hip.
Or what can change in the university to bring that back in?
Because rebellion by the grad students. This is what I'm trying to foment. Mm-hmm. Okay, we absolutely need someone to stand up, okay, and start criticizing authority figures. But no, okay, this generation of young people have been trained throughout middle school and high school and college, okay, to be subservient to authority. There is no question of authority or whatever. They want an expansion of authority. Everything of my generation stood against. Okay? We drove the administrators out of our private lives, out of the in loco parentis mode. And now today's kids have been raised in a helicopter parent fashion. They feel warm and cozy. Okay, by additional expansion of authority of these Budinsky, okay, people. I mean, these mediocrities who like the bureaucrats who infest university. University life has become increasingly unpalatable because of this, thanks to federal regulations, forcing the adding on of more layers of bureaucracy. It's a nightmare, an outrage, and none of the faculty have fought back. Now, they pretend to be leftists, okay? Now, they're pygmies. Okay, I'm telling you, they are passive worms, okay? Not to fight back against the bureaucrat.
Camille Paglia, a voice of reason, and yet rarely is she debated. So that's why a lot of people are leaving the university and can't tell you anything about the world we live in. Well, that's not the kind of leadership that we need going forward. Your thoughts? Let me know what you think. 888-874-4888. And here's another thing. I suggested for helping people who cannot afford college that we set money aside and fund state institutions that are free so therefore anyone who wants a quality education can get it with no debt. I also suggest that we promote more of the trade schools, and again, give scholarships to trade school, become an electrician, a plumber, a mason, whatever it is, but without the debt, but with the knowledge. Give people a chance. I also suggest that someone, my schedule is packed with documentaries, but someone do a documentary on the corruption of our educational systems. After all, what does it say when Harvard has a multi-billion dollar endowment and Duke University and Columbia University, all of them do? And why is it there's been over 1,000 increase in the inflationary tuition in the last 20 years? Why? That's all going to the university. The university is not giving quality education in all cases, and it's gone woke in many, not all. But if they're making all that money, why are they then creating a debt peonage system for the students? Why don't they just fund with their endowments students in the private universities? They could, they choose not to. So why aren't we challenging them to relieve the debt burden from people who went to those universities? Just some suggestions. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
And it goes into how every day we're breaking another record from the previous day globally. And this is not good when you consider the consequences, which I'll get into on tomorrow's show. How are we supposed to help people who have no resources because they're either flooded out or they're in a drought and they can't survive? There's nothing being done to help them at this moment. Right now, we just want to mention, and we're going to say goodbye to WBI. That's going to go to the news. We're going to continue on PRN.live, PRN.live. We have Luann Panisi on the phone, and I've invited Luann for a reason, because yesterday I did a five-hour webinar, which we're going to post sometime this coming week. But more importantly, last night I did a discussion, which I do every Sunday night, with either the group that was on campus or the group that is the control group at home, meaning they both got the same identical input, but one was in a more controlled environment and the other, well, you had to control yourself. And for the first time, we're actually seeing people in the home environment, which has been disastrous. Nobody follows the protocols at home, and it looks like they're following the protocols, and I was very inspired by this. And one of the things that we're missing is that we're not giving ourselves an opportunity to de-stress, to say for a moment, I've been responsible for myself and others my whole life. I need a respite. I need a moment to myself. Without cell phones, without television, without propagandists, without ideologists, without someone yelling at me, if I've said the wrong word, people don't give themselves that break. Even when they go on a vacation, imagine you just went on the 4th of July vacation, spending an entire day in an airport, and then they say, well, not till tomorrow, so you have to pay for your own hotel room and an Uber or a car or a cab. And then the vacation that you're going to de-stress on becomes highly stressful. I don't think Americans know how to de-stress. I don't think we believe we deserve that quality time. And when you have that quality time, suddenly you can change your perception on how hyperkinetic life can be when you're overdoing something. So we're going to be doing a retreat, it's not anti-aging. That anti-aging is going to go on for months and months, but just for people who need a break, who need to get into a beautiful environment, have wonderful workshops, phenomenal vegan gourmet food, and exercising, meditation classes, Tai Chi classes, Qigong, drumming, circles, power walking, gym workouts. It's a wonderful time to do as little or as much as you want. But most importantly, when you hear testimonials, people are exhaling and they're re-inhaling new meaning and purpose in their life. Let's just go to the tape and play it to people who are at a recent health retreat.
My name is Amina, and I completed a week of 18 and 24 Gary's retreat. I had a good time and learned a lot. And when I got home, I had problems before with blood pressure and sugar. And then when I got home, my sugar was down to 83 and blood pressure normal, my kidney working properly, and I'm feeling great. I had a good time, I learned a lot, and I am thankful to Gary and Luann for giving us all that they did. And we had a good time, definitely. Best of all, I am back to my normal self, and I can enjoy my life. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is John. And for years, I lived in Los Angeles and had lived in a wonderful area, and I had a very good career as an actor and an acting coach, and have coached beginners to major stars. I did that for years, maybe 25, 30 years. But I was in a rut, and I was doing the same thing every day, and I knew that if I didn't make a change, my life is going to stay the same. Also, the quality of life in Los Angeles was deteriorating with the droughts, with earthquakes, with just the quality of life. And then when COVID hit, with people were so rigid, I chose not to get vaccinated, and I was demonized. I lost work. I lost friends. I lost some family members. I just didn't feel free to speak what I wanted to say what I wanted to say. In 2009, a wildfire was close to where I lived, and my neighborhood was evacuated. We came within minutes of the whole neighborhood being incinerated. So the quality of life was really deteriorating. I had visited Northeast Texas in Mineola here for retreats a number of times and worked with both Luann and Gary, and realized that this simpler life with better quality of life was what I really wanted. It was less stressful. The quality of life was better. The air was better. The water was better. It was cleaner. It was safer. It was quieter. And the thought of not living in a large city really, really appealed to me. There's certainly a lot less stress here. It's a small, intentional community. We have things like yoga and meditation. We have gym work. And we have lots of green space, animals, all kinds of different animals that you go out and feed them or just be with them in nature. And my stress level would go way down.
We're out of time, but I just want to mention that John had a whole lifetime of taking just about every medication possible for depression, anxiety. He's been off all those medications. He is happy. He doesn't have depression or anxiety. He's living a quality life. That's what he got. Luann, for people who are interested in giving themselves a break to enjoy peace of mind, away from the stress of friends and family and work, give them your number, please.
Surely it's 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. I have a few spots open. Great people coming on board, Gary. Just fun people that are excited to not only hear all your information, but a lot of them just want to be in your company. They can't wait to see you live lecturing every evening, and they're excited about all the amenities and what a great time they're going to have.
Thank you, and that's going to be 1 or 2 weeks in mid-September. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much for listening. And now, stay tuned for Utrecht's Lead. Have a nice day, everyone.